Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 7th, 2011. Going right into the show tonight, a lot of topics to cover, and some issues. A lot of times I have a pretty even keel dealing with issues, but tonight I'm going to show a little bit of another side, and it's because of the reactions of people, just people that don't get it. And I'll explain a little bit more about that later. I'll be talking a little bit about Comet Elin. It's a comet that's going to show itself here in a while, coming up in September. And so there's a lot of misinformation about that comet, a lot of misinformation going around the internet. So I'll do an initial analysis this week, and I'll continue talking about that. But unfortunately, people are using my name, and that's a problem. That's an issue that I just have to address. There are a lot of people will quote me and then talk about Comet Elin like it's going to crash into Earth and we're all going to die, that type of thing. So at any rate, I'll be talking a bit about that. First of all, just a number of topics here. Japan had another 7.1 earthquake today. The results that they say, very little damage, nobody died. One of the nuclear reactors, the staff left the nuclear reactor, so when the quake hit. But I'm not sure. I also heard some interesting commentary that Japan's visitors, the visiting tourism, you might call it, visiting of Japan, is maintaining. And so I don't know where economics plays into these announcements. And no one really has the ability to confirm these announcements. So at any rate, that's something that just very difficult to say. I wanted to talk a little bit about nuclear fallout from Japan. I thought it was interesting. There's a book that's called The Nuclear Survival Handbook. And it's a book that was written a very long time ago. I'm sure it's gone through many, many printings. A lot of people have this, but it originally was written to guide you through a nuclear attack that may have occurred between Russia and the United States. And on one of the pages, there's a fallout map. Now, this would be if a nuclear bomb that we sent to Russia would fall. The example is just one location in Russia that would be bombed, and then this map shows the fallout trail that would actually swing in an easterly direction from Russia and end up coming into the west coast of the United States a number of days later as it rode the jet stream around the world. Interestingly enough, on this map in the Nuclear Survival Handbook, the radiation pattern crosses over Japan, and then it brings that nuclear fallout. The nuclear fallout coming from Russia would eventually end up in the United States. So I just thought it was interesting that way back then. Now, understand that this would be a scenario in which Russia launched no nuclear attack on us. In other words, we were able to knock them out before they got us. Well, some people might think that, gee, we won the war, right? Well, wrong, because all of that radiation, even from a single bomb, would end up polluting the United States as the fallout from that bomb worked its way around the world in the ocean or in the jet streams. Now, the point is, one of the other things I want to make a comment on, I've talked last week about accumulation of radiation, how the radiation had already shown up in milk in certain states, and the amount of radiation that had to be in the field where the cow was eating the grass to produce enough radiation where it would end up getting in the milk in measurable quantities so that when you had the glass of milk on your table, you could actually measure the radiation in the milk. And so that's, and this is only 20 days at the time I was reporting, that was only 20 days after the earthquake and tsunami and then ultimate rupture of the, in fact, the meltdown of the reactors didn't even happen for a number of days after that, so it even was less than 20 days. It was probably more like 15 days for the radiation to cross the ocean, fall on the grass fields, the cows eat it, and it turns up in milk that's on the table, that's already been produced and through the processing companies and put on the table in 15 days. So that means to me, that tells me that there's a lot of radiation out there, because that cow didn't, in that amount of time, didn't have a chance to eat that much grass, if you understand what I'm saying. So the radiation, clearly the radiation reporting is completely underplayed or underreported. And I'm sure this is to save the nuclear industry, the tourist industry in Japan, and the airline industry, which has a big investment in flights. Those are the golden flights. Those are the cream of the flights to Japan. Those are the big money makers for the airline companies, etc. So at any rate, but I went to a conference a number of years ago, and there were some scientists there that were making a point. And at the time, there was some chatter about, oh, we're going to just drop one nuclear bomb in Iran. We just, because they were digging their nuclear research facilities deeper and deeper, and the bunkers that these were in were designed by German scientists who said, yeah, even a small nuclear bomb could not penetrate these. And the bunker busters that the United States was developing at the time could not get through to the bunkers where the research was being done in the Iranian nuclear research program. And so this led to the chatter that, oh, well, we'll just nuke them. And it turns out that nuclear bombs are not that good at drilling holes in the ground. If you can drill a hole in the ground and get a nuclear bomb down there, okay, then you've got a nuclear bomb underground. But to try and blow a hole in the ground from a nuclear bomb is simply not that effective. So, but basically what you would do in dropping a bomb in Iran, according to the scientists that were in the program, they said that the fallout would eventually make its way all around the world. They also made a statement that the dust blown up by these smaller nuclear reactions, nuclear bombs, literally nuclear bombs set off in the atmosphere, would set up dust clouds that would affect weather and could eventually cause crop failures in the United States, as it would, the dust clouds would cover the air. And then there was also the radiation factor, that you would have radiation. So literally, by dropping these small nuclear bombs in Iran, we would be affecting our own ability to survive in the United States. In other words, we would have repercussions here, whereas the political scene, they're just thinking, oh, we'll just drop some of these little nuclear bombs over in Iran. And these scientists were pointing out that this is not a good idea. So I want to compare this to what happened in Japan. You have bomb-grade plutonium being run in the nuclear plants. The plants spit this out after a meltdown and then continue to spit it out to the rate at which a cow in with... Now, remember, in the 15 days after the... that it took for the cow to eat that grass, a lot of that time was in just the radiation reaching the United States. So some time was lost there because the radiation would have to come by the jet stream and then accumulate in the grass in sufficient levels where the cow would eat it, ingest it, turn it into milk, then the milk goes to be processed and goes to the table. So for that to happen within 15 days, there was a lot of radiation coming in from Japan. That's the only way you can cut it. So at any rate, now I want to talk about the point about the nuclear survival handbook, which is available online, is that the map from Russia also in a subtle way pointed out the same issue. that if we dropped nuclear bombs or shot rockets through Russia and put nuclear bombs and exploded them in Russia, eventually that fallout would get back to the good old U.S. of A. and affect us. Okay, now I want to continue the talk about accumulation. And this is important in the food chain, especially one of the most important food chains on the one of the most important food chains on Earth, that is in the ocean. And now many studies have been done on, for example, the level of mercury in fish. Most fish, especially inland lakes in the United States now, and fishing where the fish are in the ocean, most fish have a limit on what you can eat because of the mercury levels in the fish. And here's how it works. The smallest organisms in the ocean, the plankton, small cellular plants, basically draw water in and take nutrients out of the water. Then the next size up of creature, you might call it, comes along and eats the plankton. Then the next size creature comes along and eats the thing that ate the plankton. And this continues up until you get to the bigger fish who are eating smaller fish like tuna or salmon, commercial fish, and they're eating smaller fish. Well, every time they eat a small fish, they're eating their own weight, basically, in the there's an equation, and it shows the scientists have shown how accumulation occurs. One of the most commonly illustrated examples of this type of accumulation is with mercury in fish. And so they say pregnant women should not eat so much, they should only be limit themselves to this amount of fish or a certain amount of fish, etc. So the issue is that in the sea, in the world of fish, seafood, etc., the accumulation is cumulative. And so over time, as I saw an article today, it said, will the ocean clean up the radioactive fallout from Japan? And the answer is, sure, it'll clean it up, and it's going to end up in the fish. That's how it gets cleaned up, if you want to call it that. I wouldn't call that cleaning up. I would call that pollution of the sea and pollution of the food chain, because the plankton draws in a tremendous amount of the seawater, filters that seawater, and all of those impurities end up in the bigger fish that finally eat the next size down fish in the food chain. Okay, so then they catch those fish, put them on the table for you and me to eat. So in time, over time, and as time goes on, and as the radiation builds up in the ocean from the failed Japanese nuclear reactors, especially the Pacific Ocean, and especially close to Japan, the level of radiation in seafood is going to go up. Now you have Japan is a nation that eats a lot of seafood. So they have basically just poisoned the food that they would eat and the food that their kids would eat in the upcoming generations. And so the question is, will the ocean clean this up? Yes, in a very strange sort of way, to the point that it will be eaten by humans eventually. And so I just want to point that out. That's a continuation of the talk that I gave last week dealing with the accumulated effects of nuclear fallout. So if you missed last week's show, go back and listen to that. Every week we have a lot of new listeners, and this whole world of, the world of James McCanney and what I'm trying to teach on this radio show, it's very complicated. So I appreciate the fact that people are out there, and I get to talk to them occasionally for various reasons. But the point is that this is a very complex world. And for new people who are new to this, be aware that there is a lot of planted misinformation out there, a lot of people that try and talk and say similar things to what I'm trying to talk about. But these are, many of them are government-sponsored locations. you have to ask in a lot of these cases, where do these people get their spiffy websites and where do they get their information? Who supports them? Et cetera, et cetera. How can some websites get pictures every day from NASA picture archives, fully explained and with all the detail and formatted exactly so that these pages can put them up? Where does this come from? Well, it comes from government-sponsored programs to put information out there to try and divert you, the public. So you have to be pretty aware of what's going on. So I'm just cautioning people that are new to this game, so to speak, just be aware. The internet is full of misinformation. And remember, the one thing is the government misinformation people, you rarely see them. They have a lot of people they use. So there are a lot of people out there with little egos that need boosting, let's put it that way. And pretty much with misinformation is that the one of the easiest ways to use people is to use their egos. You don't have to pay them any money. The price is right. All you have to do is stroke their little egos a little bit, make them think that they're important, and sometimes give them a badge or even a security clearance. Wow. And these people are yours. You can tell them to do anything. And they just, out of feeling of importance, will do almost anything. So at any rate, just be aware of this as you search the internet for information and copycat information, that type of thing. Okay, so I've talked about the fallout. I just wanted to make a quick comment. There are groups of people out there continually in the business of changing history and trying to exonerate themselves as being all kinds of things in history that never were. And so that's something that's been going on today. You probably, a lot of you know who I'm talking about, but entire groups of people who try and promote that they did all kinds of things in history and that really didn't happen. And this is really causes a lot of problems in the world when you have people like that who are changing history, trying to rewrite history, and then getting very belligerent when other people point out that this is really not the way history was. So at any rate, okay. Now, let me see if I've gone through my list here. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the products on my webpage, but there's a rationale for what I do. The information I put out in the books, the information about science, the information about how comets work, how the solar systems work, all of this blends together. But one of the things I also believe in is being prepared, and that's why I have a few items on my webpage. Not many, not as many as some people have on webpages to become prepared. And but here's the situation. The things I put on my webpage are, first of all, excellent quality. Very high quality in everything that is there. So that's the first thing, and it's very well chosen. And now I've been around this business for a very long time, and so over time, yes, I've accumulated some things that I happen to sell, some of them relatively exclusive things that I sell. And so the point is that I don't just choose things to sell just to have something to sell. These are things that you need. So when I talk about preparedness, I get this feedback from people. This is where this is coming from. For example, I talked to a woman today, and she wasn't really sure if she wanted the mini travel filter or not. She wasn't sure if she wanted the pre-filter or not. And so I'm thinking, you know, a lot of these people just don't get it. These are not products that you're buying because, you know, they're for sale at the county fair that are nice to have. The food is not there because you're going to buy it for the family picnic. These are things you need in case of emergency. If there's an emergency, you need water. woman was talking to today, she says, well, yeah, I got a few extra bottles of water in my car. And so, you know, you have to try and talk to people. But what occurs to me is basically people don't get this. What is this all about? It is trying to get basic things into the hands of people, and maybe your survival trek will only be a day. Maybe it'll be 2 days. Maybe it'll be a week. Maybe it'll be forever. And there won't be anything, there won't be any infrastructure. There are a lot of people in Japan who don't have anything, and they won't have anything anymore, because the big government truck in Japan isn't rolling up the street and down the street to deliver all of the stuff that they've purchased for survival, because you know what? They didn't buy any survival. They kept their economy running at full steam ahead like there was no tomorrow, except the one thing they never thought of, or if they thought of, they never did, was to prepare for the future in case of an emergency. So you have millions and millions of people in Japan, and this is the untold story of Japan. You don't ever see this in the newspaper. You see the destruction, but it doesn't talk about the people. What's going on with the people in Japan? So in the same situation, the United States is totally unprepared. This is about getting as much preparedness items into your hands as possible. When the Mountain House announcement came out a number of weeks ago, stating that things were just not going to be generally available anymore, I think it was should have been very obvious to most people out there that somebody stepped in and prevented and was very adamant about preventing you, the public, from getting this stuff. I had a person this last week that tried to accuse me of being giving out faulty information and tried to accuse me of being a crook. And so it was without, in a most subtle way, I had to explain that this is the government or the entities that have the ability to come in and buy up all the food, number one, so they get it all, and number two, so you don't get any. But luckily, at the same time, the grab-and-go buckets were coming into place, and they are available. And so I want to give you a little bit of a view into the daily life of what it's like to get these items out to the public. Some Mountain House items are still coming in. So they might be a day when so many cases of, say, granola comes in. There might be another day when so many cases of corn comes in. It's not like Mountain House has 75 lines in production and each line is producing this stuff. They have kind of a single-threaded production line. And so the people that dealt with this typically had to store up this stuff as it came in. Well, now you might get one thing, you might get two things, you might get three things, but as soon as that comes in, it's going to orders that are already sitting there. So now imagine your order. You're John Q. Public, you have an order coming in, you're in line, and your order is now in the shipping bin, so to speak. It's getting filled. People look around. Okay, here's the things that were ordered. We have this and this and this. Okay, and then at this point, a decision has to be made, and there's only one decision, and that is that the part of the order, or some of the order, maybe all of the order, because all of the things are not there and they're not expected in, would be then shipped as grab-and-go buckets. An equivalent shipment would be made. This is about getting the most economical way of producing and packaging and shipping the most stuff to the most people in the most expedient way. It's not like we have 80 people on the floor, all that run around and have time to call everybody and say, now, gee, Mrs. Jones out there, here's the results I got from trying to do this initially. One lady's on the phone. She says, well, you know, my children don't like carrots, and we're not sure if we like some of the powdered milk that might be in some of the stews that might be in these. So we would like to decide. Now, look, understand, lady, your packaging is here on the shipping dock. We got to put this together, and there's 100 people behind you that don't have anything yet, and they're waiting to be in the position you're in because of the time. We don't have time to figure out if little Johnny or little Susie like carrots or not. Do you understand this? This is about emergency. This is about getting the products out to the people in the most expedient way. And now, this is what I'm talking about. The reason I'm raising my voice is because I get angry at people who don't get it. They don't understand that this is not buying food for the family picnic next week. This is about having food in your house to eat when there is no other food. Do you understand this? So, if you understand that, then you will understand that the most expedient way to deal with the issue where the Mountain House food was taken off the market. Now, if you want your eggs and bacon, and that there don't happen to be there when this comes to the shipping time for your order, then you know, you have to understand what you're getting is food that's going to be for emergency. We cannot cater to everybody's whims and this, and, well, little Johnny doesn't like carrots. I'm sorry, this is not, these products have been put together by people who've been in the survival business for a long time. They understand what nutrition is, and these are very well put together packages. So the issue here, now let me go back to the pre-filter. I had a lady who was talking about the pre-filter, and she goes, well, I'm not sure if I need it. I said, ma'am, the pre-filter is like a spare tire in your car. You don't need it unless you have a flat tire. And if you have a flat tire, it's the only thing that's going to fix your flat tire is that spare tire. And that's the situation with the pre-filter. If you're in a situation where a tank upstream or upriver breaks and you have chemical sludge and the infrastructure of the city water has gone down, if there's some kind of accident or natural event or an earthquake, or if there's a reactor that breaks in an earthquake in California and the country all of a sudden has pollution, it's like having a flat tire in your water system. And the only thing you're going to be able to use to get that out is the pre-filter. You don't want this stuff going into your water filter. You want to filter it out before it gets there, and then you want to filter out as much of it as you can. That's what the pre-filter is for. The pre-filter is not claiming to filter everything in the world. It gets the bulk of the gunk out before you pour the water into your water filter. So, ma'am, and other people out there, the purpose of the pre-filter is that, yeah, today when you have water coming out your faucet and it looks nice and clean, no, you don't need a pre-filter today. You're getting this, it's like the spare tire in your car that you carry around every day, because, and you don't have a flat tire every day, you probably may never have a flat tire, but you carry your spare tire around every day. You do this because it's the only thing. That spare tire is the only thing that's going to fix your flat tire in case you have a flat tire. It's the way it is. That's what survival is all about. Some people think that, now I sell the small emergency travel water filter. That is so you can carry it with you. You can put it in your purse. You can put it in a briefcase. You can carry it with you. You can have it in your car. You can filter water and then pour it into another container like one of those 2-liter Pepsi bottles or Coca-Cola bottles, that pop bottles. I don't want to promote brands of pop, but you know, you'll always find something to pour the water into. So you filter it a liter at a time. One lady didn't understand that you could put your water filter out on the dirt or on a tree stump or over on the steps over here. Or somewhere else. It doesn't have to be sitting on your kitchen counter. And one lady said, I can always take my water filter with me. I can pour the water out and take it. Well, what if you're 2 miles from home and there's a martial law and they don't allow people to go anyplace? You might have to spend 2, 3, or 4 days where you are before you can get home. The one thing you need is water. Now, I'm trying to explain this because preparedness is very simple. Some people think, well, gee, this costs some money. Yes, it does. But preparedness is very simple in one respect. Once you become prepared, you are prepared for all kinds of events because preparedness is the same. You have water that you need. That's the first thing you need. You can live a lot longer without food than you can without water. Very simple. And so the one thing you need very soon in any emergency is water and a consistent supply of water. Water that's in a jar, that's good, or bottled water, but it's not very easy to carry around. You're not going to carry gallons and gallons of water around with you, whereas a very lightweight water filter, you can carry that with you. Use any source of water, and when you get that, when you get water from any source, you can put it into the water filter, and now you have, for a very low weight, very low profile item, you have clean water. Excuse me. You have gallons and gallons of, potentially gallons of clean water. And then by the time you finally get home, you've got your bigger water filter that's at your house. If that's where your main location is, or your cabin, or wherever, you would have your main location. So, please understand. Now, I'm going to preface this, preface the next thing that I say with a statement that I believe by Sunday we will be taking the grab-and-go buckets off of the webpage for sale. And I have to look at this a bit closer, and I'm going to tell people that if they order between now and Sunday, when this comes off the webpage, that they would expect possibly, and here's what happened. There have been some very large purchases of the grab-and-go buckets recently. And so then this is what you might expect. So the lead times for these are getting out beyond what I consider acceptable, and so anybody order, and so I'm just going to cut it off because I don't believe that the lead times are acceptable. And that's, I'm projecting that we're going to hit that about Sunday night. So that's all I'm going to tell people. So if you order the grab-and-go buckets between now and Sunday, first of all, I would suggest if you really want them to get in line and get them, and that might be the end of it as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. But the reality is there has been very heavy ordering, and that's not going to go away. And the lead times are getting out there to the point that by Sunday night I will consider them probably unacceptable and take the grab-and-go buckets off the sales page. The pre-filter, so far we have been able to keep ahead, but that, like I say, if you get to the web page and the pre-filter is not there anymore, that means we finally hit a point where we consider the orders are coming in too fast on that product. So that's the way it is. The stainless steel water filters, we've been able to keep up, but just keep up with the demand. So there again, if you're looking for these items, we don't know what the future is going to hold. So if you want something, order it now. That's all I can tell you. As far as the books are concerned, and this is strange too, at the same time, just about my books have been selling very heavily lately. And we are actually, all of these books have to go into reprint pretty soon to keep the stock there. So people out there are waking up on a scale that I've never quite seen before. All of this seems to be happening at one time. This would lead me to believe that people are sensing this kind of like animals sense a earthquake coming or something like that. But the situation in the United States is going to be critical. I was talking with someone today who went through a summary of what's going on in the world today. Excuse me. The Russian wheat crop has already known to be a failure. The European food situation is going to be critical. England is heading into summer where we already know it's going to be a cold summer because the warmth that should be going there to warm that island during the summer months is not leaving the Gulf area of Mexico. That ocean current cycle is not being fed, and so the situation is that England is going to have some problems. Japan is a nation with millions of people, all who like to eat, who have a critical problem. Their economy is completely upside down. They're a nation which does not produce much. They're a nation which depends heavily on seafood. They've just polluted the area around their island, and it's going to become more polluted as the accumulation grows in the marine life. Australia is having crop failures this year. The food situation is going to be critical worldwide. So I don't know what it takes to wake people up. So when a lady tells me on the phone that she's a little worried because Johnny doesn't like carrots, I'm trying to imagine little Johnny not eating at all and how he would probably like carrots in that state. People don't get it. They don't get the idea that this is food that's going to be in your house, that's going to be available for you when there is nothing else. I don't know how to explain, and as I said before, this is not buying food for the family picnic. It's not going to an exclusive restaurant where you get to choose and pick all of the things that you want on your plate. This is about getting the most food and supplies into the hands of the most people possible. That's what it's about. So for people to try and get particular at this point, no one really has time to deal with it because we are very busy. The people that are involved in this, including myself, are to the wall busy trying to get the stuff out to the people who have ordered. So that's the name of the game. So now if you understood what it was like, that puts a lot of pressure on the people who are shipping, the people who are trying to coordinate all this. And one guy wanted me to call. He says, well, I emailed and I wanted to check all of this out a number of days in advance. You have to understand, from day to day, we do not know what's going to be available. Things come in and things go out faster than they come in, if you can imagine this. So some Mountain House stuff might be coming in. The question is, when your order gets to the floor to be shipped, what's going to be there at that time? That's all we can, and at that time, we have to deal with the issues. And at that time, we have to do this in the most expedient fashion so that the 100 people behind you are not held up by somebody hemming and hawing over whether little Johnny likes carrots or not. I hope you all understand this. This is not buying food for the family picnic next week. This is buying survival food. Okay, well, enough of that. I'm going to talk about Comet Elan a little bit. I did an analysis of the orbit of Comet Elan, and I'm going to talk about the first part of the orbital situation. It occurs on September 11th, and there's been a lot of misinformation on the Internet regarding this date. It happens to be also the date of anniversary of 9/11. Gee, isn't that interesting? A comet coming through the solar system, a quite natural event, but there's a lot of hype out there. Now, here's the orbital situation for Comet Elan. It's an orbit that lays in the planets, in the plane of the planets, called the ecliptic. Pretty much. I mean, it's a little bit out of the plane, but not much. So it's coming in, and on the date of September 11th, it's going to be inside the orbit of Venus. And it'll be in a somewhat of an alignment with the planet Earth. At that time, Earth's moon will be on the far side of Earth from the sun, nearly a full moon. These are general dates. I believe the full moon is on the 12th of September this coming year. So we have a full moon, and that alignment can add a little bit of activity. But with Comet Elan on the sunward side of Earth, the moon really turns into a non-factor. Now, these are electrical alignments. mind you, that none of the other major planets in the inner solar system will be aligned with Earth at that time. So this is a comet which is relatively small from what we can tell at this point. And there is an alignment with Earth. Can there be some effects? Yes, it's right in the somewhat the heart of the hurricane season. Could we have some advanced weather? Yes. How long does this electrical alignment last? Well, it's going to last, probably about a week. It'll peak around September 11th, so anywhere from the 5th of September to the 15th of September, 16th of September. Somewhere in that time frame, there could be some advanced weather, hurricanes, situations like that. But Comet Elan itself is very far away, and the tail of Comet Elan will be very far away. Could there be some virus activity from the comet? Well, it's possible because we do get virus activity from Venus when the tail of Venus swings around. I've given many lectures on that, how the Venus still presents a comet tail. And every year, or every whatever it is, every cycle where the inferior conjunction of Venus is, in other words, Venus is aligned with the Sun, we have the situation where Venus produces enough virus in its tail at the position where Earth passes through the tail that we get what is known as the swine flu. This is in the medical journals, this association with the inferior conjunction of Venus. So is it possible that Comet Elan could have some viral activity? Because we know that the DNA and the particles of DNA are, in fact, in the tails of comets. And those building processes do occur. I mean, could that happen? Yeah. Could you eventually be sick? Possibly. Is it something that we have to spread all over the Internet so people become prepared? No, not any more than any other comet that might pass through the solar system and become aligned with Earth. So, and if you did become sick around September 11th to 16th or something like that, could anybody prove that what you got came from Comet Elan? That would be extremely difficult to prove. So, at any rate, that's the first part of the analysis of Comet Elan. Some people wrote in and asked, could I comment on the September 11th issue with Comet Elan? So, at any rate, I'll continue talking about Comet Elan in future shows. But at this point, when you look at the entire situation of the solar system and the fact that Comet Elan will be really quite far away, and the fact that the Earth's moon is full on the far side of the Earth, really, the Earth is blocking it, so it's like the moon is not even there at all when you're dealing with these electrical alignments. The Earth is actually shielding all the electrical activity that would normally happen with the moon. At that point, you have to say that in terms of, let's put on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the worst effect, 0 being no effect. The effects of Comet Elan might be a 0.5 or 1/2 or not even a 1 on a scale of 0 to 10. You know how they in the hospital ask you your pain. Is your pain a 0 or a 10 or what number? Is it a 5 or a 6 or a 7, whatever? Well, the potential effects of Comet Elan in September 11th, what I would say be about a 0.5. And that doesn't say that nothing will happen. It just says that. Now, I've had other cases in the past where I believe it was Comet Lee that came around behind Earth, which contributed, this was back in the Hurricane Floyd days when there were 4 hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean at one time, and I predicted that. That was a September comet. That was a set of September hurricanes, and I predicted that in May that year. I said there's going to be some tremendous storm activity in the Atlantic that year because of these configurations, and it was so blatant, the alignments were so, there were so many multiple alignments that it was just absolutely bound to happen. And that prediction came true, and I just said there would be heavy hurricane activity. Even I didn't expect that there would be four hurricanes in the Atlantic all at the same time, full-blown hurricanes at the same time, with a fifth one developing off the coast of Africa as that electrical alignment took place and the moon tripped it. There was a triggering that happened with the new moon at that time. You can read about that in my weather book. That's very, very well documented in there. So at any rate, I will be continuing discussions with Comet Helene. So now, for some people who are new, I hope that people understand that many people have been listening to the show for years, and so they understand when I talk about electrical alignments, and they also understand there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of websites that will use my name and then talk about Comet Helene like it's going to be the most disastrous thing that ever happened to Earth, quoting September 11th. And I tell people this, and I can't keep track of everybody who's out there trying to use my name and trying to, there was a time when we could do that, but it's so prolific right now. The one thing I can say is if you want to hear what I have to say, you go to my webpage, you listen to my radio show, and listen to what I say, not what somebody over there says I said, or their interpretation, or the things they're trying to add to what I say. If you want to hear what I have to say, it's only on my webpage. I don't sponsor or authorize any other people to use my name or my material. And so if you want to know what I'm talking about on a specific topic, listen to my radio shows, listen to read the webpage, and that's how I communicate with the public. So just a small review on cometary activity. Here, somebody was asking me, relatively new to the show the other day, that they were asking about the diamonds produced in comets. And here's the situation. So I'll describe the comet activity in general and then talk a little bit about diamonds as produced in the nose part of a comet. When I talk about the nose, it's actually out in space, out in front of the comet nucleus where diamonds can be produced. Not all comets are going to be powerful enough to produce diamonds. But at any rate, here's the situation. The sun is a fusion reaction. We all know that, but standard science says that fusion reaction is deep in the core. And if you do the physics and the mathematics and follow that to its logical conclusion, then the surface of the sun should be a big glowing orange ball at about 6,000 degrees. And so that's what we call black body radiation, and it should have a very characteristic signature with the heat emanating from the sun along this very evenly around the surface. And one of the math problems that we had to do, one of the physics problems, every undergraduate in physics probably has to do this, that it takes about a million years for the X-ray energy, if you took the core model, nuclear core model of the sun, it would take about a million years for that energy to migrate up to the surface. One of the side products of that type of a calculation or that type of physics is that the surface of the sun should be extremely uniform. There should be no rips or bumps or wrinkles or waves or anything at the surface of the sun. And so but when you look at the sun, and that's for a long time what scientists believed, that the sun was just this big glowing ball at 6,000 degrees. They had no idea that there were electrical factors. They didn't understand the solar corona, which is a field of electrons which orbits the sun. These are not just any electrons. They are relativistic electrons. They are orbiting the sun at relativistic speeds. Now, how do you get an electron to orbit the sun at relativistic speeds using just gravity? Well, it's ridiculous, but that's standard science. The ridiculous nature of what I call the fairy tale science starts there, and it just goes on and on. The number of contradictions is nearly endless. So there's another story to the sun. What I finally figured out when I was doing my research and I had to figure out where the electric fields were coming that were powering the comets, it of course was coming from the sun, but it led me down the track of understanding that the sun was an electrical fire at the surface of the sun. And not above the surface, not at the surface, but below the surface, in the atmosphere of the sun, it was an electrical fire with lightning kicking off the fusion. And so basically part of that reaction was to separate charge, cause an electrical battery, and that's where the solar wind comes from. The standard science always talks in terms of magnetic fields causing all of this. Well, magnetic fields don't just self-generate by themselves. They need electric currents to cause the magnetic fields. So at any rate, a lot of electrical activity going on, but part of the end solution here was that the sun was firing out protons, and at a greater rate, a higher current, a higher electric current, which is the product between velocity and charge. So it could either be at a higher velocity, or it could be at a greater number of protons leaving the sun, or a combination of the two. And so there had to be an electric circuit in the solar system, the sun pumping out an excess of positive charge, and then there had to be return currents to the sun to keep this process going. It couldn't just throw out protons forever. So there had to be a return current that kept a balance there. And we happened to pass through that electrical return current in the month of August. And that's why we get the peak hurricane season, we get the peak tornado season, we get the peak of the typhoon season in the Pacific, and we get the peak of the aurora season, in all occurring in August. Well, gee, what's so special about August? That just happens to be where the Earth passes through that return current sheet back to the sun as we are in the month of August in our position around the sun. Now imagine an object in this solar system. There is a capacitor. It's a battery. And I always use the example of the backyard bug killer. Everybody has seen this, I'm sure. There's a fluorescent light in the middle, and then there's a couple of electrical grids, high voltage electrical grids. And the bug flies in, it's attracted to the fluorescent light, it gets zapped, and by the current that comes from the electrical plates. They're like screen plates, so the bug can fly through. But what's so characteristic about this? Well, there's a voltage there, and it never discharges unless that bug is in there. And when the bug is in there, it always discharges along the path of the bug. Well, the solar system is exactly the same way. So if you have an object in the solar system, it's going to discharge that solar capacitor, and the current is going to run down, passing through that object and going all the way to the sun. That's the discharge. The Earth's doing it, Jupiter's doing it, Mars is doing it, Venus is doing it, comet nuclei are doing it, dust particles are doing it. Every object in the solar system, from little to big, is doing this. Now you bring in an object, foreign object from the far reaches of the solar system or from beyond, it comes cruising into this capacitor. What's it going to do? It's going to discharge that capacitor also. The characteristic comet shape is the positively charged dust and ion flow that comes in as the nucleus, as this discharge takes place. Electron beams come in a beam out from the sun. That's the majority charge carrier in this discharge. And then that causes the comet nucleus to charge up, which is just a rock. It could be a snowball. It doesn't have to be. It could be just a hot, dry rock, and that's what they typically are. No water on them at all, especially the small ones. And so anyway, this object is discharging the solar capacitor. The majority of the discharge is in terms of electrons. They're the smallest charged particles of the major family of nuclear particles that we have. So the electrons come out in great numbers. They charge up the nucleus to a negative potential, and so that negatively charged nucleus draws in a cloud of positively charged ions and dust particles, etc., and there's a whole myriad of effects that take place when this happens. So at any rate, the visible part of the comet is the tail. That's the part we see, the ions and the dust that are moving in. Scientists have put satellites out behind in the tail region of comets, and they measure what are called neutrals. This is because the electrons that are floating around the nucleus and the incoming ions, which are positively charged in general, meet, and they create neutrally charged atoms. Not positively charged, not negatively charged, but neutrals. And these go floating back out in the solar wind, and the scientists sit there with their satellites measuring neutrals, and they go, oh gee, these are the atoms coming off the nucleus of the comet. There's nothing, this is just misinterpretation. They're looking at something that they have no idea of what they're looking at. Scientists have gotten near 5 comets now and taken pictures. Not a single one of them is this icy snowball. They don't see ice or snow at all. They're typically a hot, dry rock. But there's a whole political side of why they don't want to admit this. So at any rate, now let's go back to diamonds. When that electron beam comes in from the sun, it starts encountering the atmosphere of the comet way out in outer space, far to the sunward side of the comet nucleus. You can do this experiment. By the way, this is explained in my book, The Diamond Principle, in greater detail. But basically, the electron current, you can do this in a vacuum chamber in a laboratory. In fact, that's where this process was originally discovered. You take rarefied carbon, basically a carbon gas. You take a piece of carbon, vaporize it in a vacuum chamber, and you introduce an electric current of electrons. What happens is the carbon atoms start to form spheres, very tightly bound spheres, and they do this, and then they layer up. They're called onion spheres. They're layers and layers of carbon in concentric spheres. And inside of that carbon structure, you have more carbon. Now this carbon structure is extremely strong, and you can get the pressures and temperatures necessary to form diamonds. So the diamonds actually form in this cocoon, in this round spherical shell of diamonds. So at any rate, that's the situation with that's how diamonds form on the very far to the sunward side from a comet nucleus. That's, as I said, that's also where the X-rays in comets are found, as this electron beam starts to encounter the nose side atmosphere of the comet around the comet nucleus. So I'm running out of time here, but at any rate, go to the web page. I suggest that people start to understand the true nature of survival and what it means to get survival products, and how lucky you are to be able to get these, sometimes in any form, and how hard people are working behind the scenes to make sure you can still get these items, in spite of the fact that the government is working very hard to keep you from getting them. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.